have money today.
Good afternoon.
I think that you're...
Want to welcome everybody to this joint session of the House Judiciary Committee, the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee, the Human Services, the Health and Human Services Subcommittee, the Ways and Means Committee, and the Senate Judiciary Committee is also present. Have I missed anybody? I think those are the committees that we've got here. We'll have some other members who will be coming in to the extent we can fill up the upper dais. We'll fill up the upper dais, and then any overflow members will be at the tables down below. We appreciate all of you who are going to be participating in this presentation today as we begin a two-day session on the public safety system and a mapping discussion that I think is very useful. This is perhaps, at least in my short experience in the Capitol, the first time I've seen these committees all meeting jointly for purposes of all trying to get on the same page in these discussions as the policy committees address issues that are also important, obviously, at the subcommittee level and the ways and means level. I'm joined by, on my right, by Chairman Patridge from the Public Safety Subcommittee and Chairman Winters from the Health and Human Services Subcommittee of Ways and Means. And to the extent we know that Senator Minnis and a number of the senators are double booked in committees this afternoon as well, and we hope to get as many of them here as we possibly can. For those committee members, I should let you know that those people back in the back holding signs are not actually protesters yet, and I underscore yet, but they are part of the presentations that we're going to be seeing today, and it is now my pleasure to turn the introduction for the presentation over to Marla Ray, who at the request of the chairman's has agreed to be the flight path control engineer for today's program. So, Marla Ray.
Chairs Williams, Patridge, Winters, members of the various committees, my name is Marla Ray. I have the pleasure of being the air traffic controller for the balance of your next two afternoons. I was telling Senator Gordley that it was either because I was the victim of being in the wrong place or the wrong time. I want to be clear today and tomorrow that I represent nobody in particular, and that I represent everybody in this room all at the same time in the course of the next 2 days. Our purpose in today's presentation and tomorrow's really is to show you the significance of the interrelationships and interdependency of the various components of the public safety system. This project really began at the end of last year. I'd like to introduce at this time Committee Counsel Bill Taylor, Craig Prinz. The Judiciary Committees are quite familiar with those two counsel in particular. I'd also like to introduce Robin Lamont and Doug Wilson from the Legislative Fiscal Office, two faces that are familiar to the Ways and Means Committee members. They've been tremendously involved with us in the development of this overview for the next 2 days. And I also want to acknowledge, Mr. Chair, the efforts of Judy James in the Legislative Fiscal Office, who assisted tremendously in gathering all of the information, the documents, and putting together for us the PowerPoint presentation. You'll have in your packet two documents in the first instance. One is the agenda for our presentation. We'll break at some appropriate time today and pick up tomorrow with what we've not concluded today. We'll have an overview of the public safety system that you'll see here in just a minute, a very brief budget overview, a presentation on the law enforcement components, and that's not just police. So please keep in mind that when you see something that says law enforcement, we're really talking about multiple players in this process. That will include, for example, 911, police at the state and local level, jails, those kinds of things. We'll then get into a discussion of the court process, which will involve prosecutors, the judges, the public defense, corrections, which is adult and juvenile, state and local, mental health, parole and probation. When we discuss intervention and prevention, that's both at the front end and the back end, and that's a very critical part to note. So our hope is that we show you in very brief fashion the interrelationships and the interdependencies of the entire system. We've often described it sometimes as a balloon, that if you push down here, something bubbles up here. So we hope to show how everything plays together. With that, another document that's in your packet to introduce Ross Shepard and Doug Harkleroad. I have a fair amount of anxiety about what's about to occur in this room. Doug and Ross have worked together for over 20 years. One is the Lane County prosecutor, the other as the public defender. In your packets is a letter from the United States Department of Justice that commends the working relationship of these two very disparate offices, but very coordinated offices, and highlighting the operation in Lane County as one of the most efficient and effective county-based programs in the country. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce Ross Shepherd and Doug Harkelrode. I've encouraged neither of them to give up their day jobs for this not quite ready for prime time players presentation.
Ladies and gentlemen, legislators and others, this presentation is brought to you by the Shepherd Player. The creators, producers, and directors are Ross Shepherd and Doug Harkelrode, hence the Shepherd Player. We are solely responsible for the content of this dramatic production. In all likelihood, it will never be repeated or sold commercially.
You want to bet?
The players have been typecast and actually performed their respective functions in the real world, except for the defendant, who is really an assistant public defender. Without further ado, I give you the talented, the exciting, and the oldest rugby player in North America, Ross Shepherd.
Ross, you'll need to come over here by the microphone.
What this little skit will try to achieve is to give you an overview of a typical criminal prosecution, a single defendant as he moves through the system. And I'd like to introduce to you the players in this little skit. They are, I think we're just going to move along the line, Mark Adams, Patty Perlow, Judge Carsten Rasmussen, Robert Ralph, Debbie Brokaw, Tara Sinks, Rick McKenna, Margaret Taylor, Nancy Houghton, Ron Chase, and a special introduction to this gentleman down on the far, my far left, Robert Christian Hanson, who is a colleague of mine at the Lane County Public Defender's Office, and is going to play the defendant. In this, the circumstance we've laid out to you today is a white male defendant, 25 years old, and we will call him Chris. He has a prior felony conviction for assault and has had car theft convictions. He, like so many of my clients, comes from a broken home. He did not complete high school. He's used various kinds of illegal drugs and abused alcohol since he was 14 years old. He doesn't have any specific job skills, and at times he does have delusional thoughts. It's clear he has a diagnosis of mental illness. So our little story this afternoon starts on a typical partly rainy, partly sunny February afternoon in Oregon. And a police officer named Mark contacting the assistant district attorney, Bill Patty.
Hi, Patty. I just completed an investigation on a methamphetamine dealer, and I'm evaluating. I'd like to review my affidavit in the first one.
Your affidavit looks good. Looks like you have probable cause. Let's take it to a judge.
Mark, raise your right hand. You swear that the contents of this affidavit are true?
I do.
Looks to me like you've got probable cause, so here's a search warrant.
Have a search warrant.
Come on in.
What do you have there in your hand?
Looks like methamphetamine. I place you under arrest.
Is that what they say?
My goodness.
Wish it was all that easy.
Here's John Manning.
We'll take you to the Lane County Jail here, Chris.
Where's
the hand? Fancy around this that way. Take this off, put your hands inside, okay? All right, Ms. Fancy, put this on your being booked in the jail.
Let me tell you, some of the details here will not be exact.
I was waiting for the
moment. Yeah. I think the overall points are accurate. That will be helpful.
Next step after the arrest, I'm taking the evidence to the crime lab. I lose methamphetamine and test it for.
The test is positive for methamphetamine. The cost is $100.
I will then take my results and the warrant back to the judge. Your Honor, we've executed the search warrant. We found what we believe in methamphetamine and the crime lab tested the positive for methamphetamine. Jimmy Hansen, take your shirt off for being released from the Cobra Crowd.
Just want to be making sure.
No excuse.
Okay, Patty, we found methamphetamine, test positive, already returned the warrant.
Took the case to the grand jury, they returned an indictment against Chris for possession of a substantial quantity of methamphetamine.
Now's the time set for the arraignment of Chris Hansen. Where's the defendant?
Your Honor, Mr. Hansen is not present. I don't have a reason for that.
The
state requests a warrant for security in the amount of $20,000.
This is a frequent occurrence throughout our state of defendants not appearing. Unauthorized warrant.
While driving through town, Chris was stopped by the local police and a warrant discovered. Yeah. Once again, taking him back to the county jail. Let him in for photo appear. All right, Mr. Hansen, nice to see you again.
And he's going to matrix right back out again. He started. He doesn't show people.
Counsel.
Counsel.
Now's
the time set for the arraignment of Chris Hansen. The defendant's president is represented by the public defender, and the state president is represented by the district attorney's office. Okay.
Your Honor, my client elected to plead a not guilty, and he'd like to request a jury trial.
That's entered. At this point, I'd like all of the players to hold their signs up. Legislators, if you would take note of the lettering down at the bottom that shows where the funding for each one of these governmental agencies or processes is. All right, Mr. Hansen's been taken before the court for his first appearance. In the next 35 days, his court-appointed lawyer is a public defender. We'll interview him, we'll investigate if necessary, we'll look through all police reports that are made available by the district attorney, and we'll negotiate, with the consent of the defendant, a resolution for the case with the prosecutor.
Mr. Attorney, how can we resolve this case? Well, your client's charged with possession of substantial quantity of methamphetamine, more than 10 grams. I propose he pleads guilty. He received 36 months of supervised probation as a probation officer, 90 days jail, a referral to the mental health division for treatment, and will defer to the court with regard to the financial obligations, the cost of statutory assessments, and the court-appointed attorney's fees. Well, I spoke to my client earlier, and he accepted that.
Now is the time set for taking plea in the matter of State versus Chris Hansen. I'm told that you wish to plead guilty, is that right?
Yes, sir.
We're going to assume that I've done all these other things that I'm supposed to do. Like
I understand
right.
My rights.
I understand that all the time. I've been here before.
I will do the show for me. I appreciate it.
And the sentence recommended is imposed, which will include court-appointed attorney fees, unitary assessment, a fine, avoiding driver's license suspension, and the other points made earlier. Counsel?
Do you agree with that?
Let me
answer that. What about that?
Is the state satisfied?
Yes, ma'am.
Ross, back to you.
Mr. Hayes, the defendant's been placed on probation with the condition that he do 90 days in jail. In this scenario, he is going to do most of those 90 days, and upon his release, he's directed to go see his probation officer.
Where's that probation officer? Mr. Hansen,
sir.
McKenna, I'm the probation officer. You're going to be working with us the next 3 years. You'll be on supervision. You've lowered the conditions of supervision, okay? You'll need to report monthly. Your amount to drink or use drugs. You're to be in an alcohol drug program, mental health treatment. You know that you're not supposed to commit any new crimes. And we want you to be employed. And we have resources to help you.
Good.
on what one of the things that we've done here today is to make arrangements for you to go see the mental health counselor. She's right here in our office, so we'll be talking to her as soon as we're through.
Great. I want to get off drugs.
That's good. I'm glad to see you get here. Not everybody who comes to court actually shows up after release.
I want to get off drugs.
This is taking a successful step. He's reporting into the county mental health department.
Hi, Mr. Hanson. I'm Margaret Taylor.
Mark.
I've been looking through some paperwork they sent over, and I found out you qualified for the Oregon Health Plan Standard Program. Unfortunately, we don't have any outpatient services to provide for you, and even if we could get some, we still couldn't provide any of the prescriptions that you might need. And I can't bolster it with community corrections dollars because that's been cut, too. And I can't refer you to the crisis center because we had to close that. So I'm sorry I can't help you today.
Chris, rather quickly and predictably, is a violation of his probation. He's overwhelmed by all the required opinions and unable to do it. And his probation officer is going to bring him back to court.
Mr. Hanson has gone to the supervision desk. We laid out all the work and we're going to need a warrant for his arrest.
I'll file a motion for a warrant to show cause why his probation shouldn't be revoked and ask the court to issue a warrant.
I'll sign the order to show cause and I'll issue a warrant for security amount of $20,000.
Well, the police stops Chris once again driving. He arrests with a stunning. Take him back to jail.
Everyone knows the drill.
Mr. Hanson, nice to see you. How's the kid? Just heard your alumni suite.
I put this on. Alumni suite.
Now's the time set for the arraignment for the show cause for Chris why his probation should not be revoked and sentence imposed.
Your Honor, Mr. Hanson admits he is in violation of probation.
We're
ready to proceed with
sentencing
today.
I sentence you to 15 months in the care custody of the Gold Oregon Department of Corrections, 18 months post-prison supervision, and remanded to the Sheriff of Transportation of the DOC for service of the sentence.
That's a lot of time.
The local jail, if you want to take Chris out to the intake center of the Department of Corrections, you know this is the first contact with the State Department of Corrections.
Inmate Hanson.
Ma'am.
Go ahead and put this on.
Thank you.
During your 15 months, you will be expected to follow all the rules, and you will also participate in a variety of work and programming which will fall within your compliance of your inmate incarceration plan. Do you understand?
Yes, ma'am.
Now completed your
15 months. Chris does 12 months of that. He's allowed to have 20% of his sentence taken off if he's a good prisoner, and he fits well in an institutional setting, so he only serves 12 months. And part of his post-prison supervision plan is then he's ordered and to a residence at Sponsors in Eugene, which is a nonprofit halfway house.
Welcome to Sponsors Halfway House, Mr. Hanson. Our goals over the next 60 to 90 days are for you to obtain full-time employment and to save enough money from that job to obtain and sustain affordable housing on your own. Stay away from alcohol and illegal drugs and meet all of your release requirements.
Yes, sir.
With some hard work on your part, with the assistance of sponsors and your parole officer and case manager, we believe that you can achieve these goals.
So at this point now, the defendant, Chris, has 18 months to either succeed or fail. He has a lot of conditions placed upon him. He has limited personal resources. The chances are that he's not going to make it. If he does not commit another crime, he will just bounce in and out of the local jail. If he commits another crime, we're going back to the beginning. We're not going to play it all back for you because it will look disturbingly similar to what you just saw.
At this point, we'd like to make a few observations about what you just saw. Ross, your first step.
The one of the salient points of all this is that you've just seen a varied and complicated funding system to these governmental agencies and with various responsibilities.
Ross, we know you're going to lose all your actors here before they go, and so we did want to give them a...
Yeah, good.
We appreciate you. That was a very well done presentation, and really, I think, mapped it out well. So
Thank you.
Go ahead now.
Thank you. Well, you saw city government, county government, state government, nonprofit organizations, and also the federal government as being part of this this situation. The federal government determining overcrowding in our jails, and I think there's still eight counties in the state that that are under that circumstance. So what we're trying to stress to you is that if at the very beginning of this process, if the Springfield Police Department passes, if the city of Springfield passes a measure to hire eight new policemen, that ripple is going to be felt certainly through the courts, through the public defense system. The prosecution has to prosecute all the cases that Springfield brings to them, and it ends up with an impact on the Department of Corrections eventually, because some of the people the Springfield police officers are arresting are going to end up in one of our penitentiaries. So what we're trying to stress to you is that this is all hooked together.
And it's critical that each of the components in the criminal justice system be adequately staffed and funded. For example, if there's no prosecutor or no public defender, the whole process just breaks down. If there is insufficient jail space, as we saw in this skit, the process breaks down when Chris fails to appear in court. If there is no crime lab scientist to test the white powder and prove it's a controlled substance, the case is not filed or it is dismissed. I need to highlight two immediate and very important concerns here. First, it is critical that indigent defense be funded between March 1st and June 30th if we are to continue prosecuting criminal cases in the state of Oregon. Second, on January 31st, we had 135 forensic scientists and staff at the Oregon State Police Crime Laboratories. Today, just a few days later, we have 50 forensic scientists and staff. This 60% reduction will make it impossible to process evidence in thousands of criminal cases, and criminals will go free. Ross, to you.
These observations you're hearing from my dear colleague and I are jointly held. And perhaps as an aside, but I can't resist saying it, I wish you could bottle the relationship that the public defender and the district attorney have in Lane County, and you could export it to all the other counties. But I'm afraid we're unique. I second Doug's assertion that it is critical that indigent defense funding, public defense funding, be addressed before the end of this biennium. If the defense lawyers are not there, these cases cannot be prosecuted, and there is a breakdown in the rule of law, and you as the lawmakers should find that unacceptable. Beyond that immediate crisis, I hope it would appear clear to you that prevention would be the answer to the problems that Chris has presented. He was abusing drugs and alcohol at age 14. One would hope that there is a treatment regimen of some sort that would fit to his individual needs. Our schools are failing our kids. This is not uncommon for my clients to be functionally illiterate and certainly not know how to use a computer in this modern age. And if Chris and his ilk, his like, had those skills, they'd be much less likely to end up in the criminal justice system.
Well, I got to start this thing off today, and I get to finish. The criminal justice system is a dumping ground for many of society's ills. The mentally ill end up in the criminal justice system over and over again when what they really need is adequate treatment for their mental illness. If we had no drug and alcohol abuse, crime would drop dramatically. We should treat drug and alcohol abuse proactively rather than as a reaction to criminal conduct. The criminal justice process will never stop domestic violence by itself. We act after the offense has occurred, not before. And although our skit did not have a victim in it today because we used a drug case, victims count in this process. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars on the defendants, and we spend very little on the victims of crime. So, As you listen to the rest of the presentations this afternoon and tomorrow from the various components of the criminal justice process, Ross and I ask you to remember the interrelatedness that hopefully we demonstrated in this skit for you of all of these components. All of them are important. All of these components must be funded adequately. And all of these components must be in balance at whatever level we're operating at. They must be in balance with the other components for the process to work properly. The last thing I would leave you with is public safety is a core function of government. Appreciate your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, it occurs to me that with a with no victim, an absolute full cooperation of the defendant, the state's pushing without contribution from the mental health, without contribution to the local halfway house, something in the vicinity of $60,000 for this particular young man in this series of incidents. Would that be approximately what we're talking about? That would be very, very minimum end of this. 1 year in the state prison, couple of rounds in the county jail. It looks like to me that you're just about $60,000.
Tom, you know what I'm going to do, because I don't know that they know that answer, but I'm going to let Robin and her team play with that number for a little bit, and before we're done tomorrow, they'll be able to give us an estimated number about what that scenario we just saw costs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, at this time, I'd like to touch briefly on some of the budget issues and their relationships that the Ways and Means Committee and the substantive committees on those bills that will be referred down to Ways and Means. Some of this is very government 101, but I think it's important for us to remember. The governor presents a proposed balanced budget to the legislature at the start of the session each year for the executive branch agencies. The Chief Justice, as a separate and co-equal branch of government, also submits a proposed balanced budget to the legislature. The legislature, obviously, as the third branch, directs those funds for public safety that are passed through to county and to local governments. Local issues include state program and revenue transfers, such as the Department of Human Services and community corrections programs. Budget drivers include decisions by local government committees and officials. We mentioned earlier that what may be important in Representative Butler's district may not be necessarily a community priority in Senator Burdick's district. So those local decisions are, and the local control, if you will, are a pretty interesting component of public safety priorities. And then, of course, decisions made by district attorneys on who to prosecute. Robin and Doug are going to bail me out when I miscue on this, and I'm going to go very briefly through just the big picture budget issues. The public safety system is about 16%. Public safety and judicial is about 16% of state expenditures. Data is not readily available of those expenditures at the city and county level. The Department of Corrections has the largest share of state general and lottery funds, followed by the Judicial Department and the Oregon Youth Authority. The Oregon State Police and the Department of Corrections have significant federal and other funds that help support their program. This is a historical picture that takes us back to the 93-95 biennium. Although the governor's budget funds the public safety system at about 2.8% above the legislatively approved level, budget cuts that were made during the 01-03 interim were not restored to most public safety and judicial agencies. Most of those agencies in public safety have reduced budgets below the 01-03 level. State police, these are obviously very painfully familiar to you all. The State Police, the Oregon Youth Authority, the Criminal Justice Commission have received significant cuts. The combined budgets for the Judicial Department and the Public Defender Services without the emergency fund reservation are about 9.9% below 0103. The governor, in his balanced budget, increased the budget for some agencies. unlike the most agencies in public safety and judiciary program area, the House Bill 5100 reductions were not carried forward in the 0305 budget. Governor wanted to avoid any prison closures that were anticipated. So you'll see that increase there. The Department of Justice, please don't think that that is a whopping increase in their budget. What that shows is the transfer of funding for child support enforcement from the Department of Human Services into the Department of Justice. So the amount that was transferred is about $11.5 million, and that accounts for almost the entire increase in the Department of Justice in the governor's proposed budget. So you'll hear more about that as the session rolls on, obviously, and you'll get into the gory details. We, again, keep in mind, our purpose today is the interrelationship. So as you take up each of those budgets, you'll see some implication into one of the other agencies, whether it's in Senator Winter's committee, whether it's in Representative Patridge's committee. At this point, we're going to move along. I'd like to introduce, to discuss the public safety and law enforcement presentation, Sheriff Raul Ramirez and Chief Mark Adams. As they come up, Sheriff Ramirez is the Marion County Sheriff. He has a 30-year career in public safety. He oversees about 306 employees in Multnomah County. That includes or Marion County, wherever you want to live this week, which includes patrol, enforcement, jail facilities, parole, and probation. So he's one of those full-service sheriffs that has the full spectrum. Raul is very involved in the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. With him is Mark Adams, whom you saw parading back and forth with our defendant. Mark has been in law enforcement for 23 years. He has, prior to becoming the chief of police of Kaiser, was the chief in Coos Bay, so he has experience both in Upper Valley and South Coast issues. President of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police last year, and has been very instrumental in working with us as the larger public safety community. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mark and to Raul.
Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Good morning, or good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. What I'm going to cover here this afternoon is who we are in the public safety community. We are more than 5,600 certified, sworn police officers, with the most of us working in city departments, sheriff's offices, and the Oregon State Police. Others work in the Oregon Liquor Commission, the Department of Justice, tribal police, and several federal law enforcement agencies. About 2,200 additional support personnel assist law enforcement in the public safety community. We're referring to 911 call takers and dispatchers, forensic scientists and technicians of the Oregon State Crime Labs, which serve all Oregon law enforcement agencies. We are also the medical examiners and mental health professionals assisting offenders and in our communities. About 400 are prosecutors, including elected district attorneys in each county and deputy district attorneys and city prosecutors. We're also lawyers and investigators and other staff at the Department of Justice. 675 county parole and probation officers working throughout Oregon. More than 100 mental health specialists and civil commitment investigators working for the courts. We're also the Oregon Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. This is an overview of the professional public safety workers throughout Oregon that serve Oregonians and the citizens of Oregon.
You've heard from Sheriff Ramirez on who we are, so let's talk about what we do. The first thing we have to do, and then law enforcement is trained. All our personnel have to go through the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training Academy and then in-service training for the rest of their careers in order that we can go out and work in our community to provide a feeling of safety for our citizens and encourage voluntary compliance with the law. We are the first contact with people in emergency situations, and we get them the help that they need. We're the guys that come around after Chris and his drug dealing buddies rip everybody off. We act to prevent crime from occurring, and we respond when it does. Sworn officers investigate crimes and accidents. They respond to breaches of the peace and cite or arrest people who violate the law. We made over 169,000 arrests in 2001. We participate in a variety of multi-jurisdictional and multidisciplinary teams or specialty teams. A few examples would be your child abuse or multidisciplinary task forces. We have interagency teams that investigate drug crimes, major person crimes such as murders and rapes. It's very common throughout Oregon today to see interagency homicide teams, major assault teams made up of numerous departments, where in the old days it would have been, this is in my turf only. It's multi-jurisdictional today. Others are involved in anti-terrorism, traffic enforcement, gang enforcement, special weapons and tactics, or SWAT teams, bomb teams. We provide security in the Capitol, courthouses all over the state, and public buildings. We provide traffic enforcement, assist people in need. We provide crowd control, serve legal papers, conduct background checks, and register sex offenders. You'll have a more complete list in your packet. There's a long list. But we also provide other things like crime prevention programs in schools and neighborhoods, working with our children, women, seniors, and we work to keep youth from joining gangs. Our medical examiners investigate circumstances surrounding unattended and suspicious deaths. Our crime lab staff collect and analyze evidence that provides investigative leads and helps convict the guilty and exonerate the innocent. This includes everything from using computers for fingerprint checks and DNA and firearm tests to match up folks or weapons involved in crimes. Everything like lifting tire tracks at a crime scene, any of the forensic work we need done at a crime scene. City and county prosecutors decide whether the criminal charges will be filed. They collect child support owed to families. They prosecute juvenile delinquents, provide assistance to crime victims, and represent the state or other agencies in a variety of other legal proceedings. The Department of Justice provides training and assistance to local prosecutors, represents the state in nearly all criminal appeals, and provide funding for victim assistance and victim compensation services. There's nearly 700 parole and probation officers in the state who supervise about 31,000 adult felons to attempt to enforce the conditions of supervision, including obtaining treatment for these folks. The mental health professionals prioritize the needs of mentally ill people to make sure that services are provided to protect themselves and others. The Department of Public Safety Standards and Training is a state agency that licenses or certifies our police, fire, corrections, and other safety professionals.
Who we affect? We affect all Oregonians by contributing to public safety and the livability of our communities. We are the first responders when called upon for the protection, security, and safety of all of our communities. Within the public safety system, we affect treatment resources, for example, taking an intoxicated person to a detox center instead of a jail, or a mentally ill person to a care facility instead of jail. Unfortunately, the dilemma of declining community resources is a reality, and a lot of our jails are becoming occupied by individuals with mental illness. This is a travesty because this is not where they belong. They belong in the community receiving treatment and help. That's not a reality anymore, and it's declining. Our schools, by providing assistance to school personnel, parents, and our youth through the DARE program, great school resource officers. We recognize that schools can't do it alone. It has to be a continual partnership between the community, parents, and public safety. Jails and juvenile detention facilities. With regards to policies on citation or arrest, policies on who do you lodge and the criteria on who do you release and when do you release. We work together to maximize the use of our limited facility resources. And I use that word limited because those numbers of individuals that are coming through the system, both juvenile and adult offenders, is continuing to climb. It will not decline. Prosecutors, arrests, citations start the process. And again, defense attorneys are part of that continuum. Courts, by bringing cases for adjudication, testifying, whether it's in justice court, municipal court, or circuit court. Intervention resources, such as accompanying parole and probation officers out on searches or investigating child abuse reports. It's a multi-task effort, and it is about collaboration and the public safety system working together to that endeavor.
There's sources of revenue that run this. These programs are varied. Most state and local law enforcement functions are funded through the general fund from state income taxes and local property taxes. Like an average city like Kaiser, 87% of our general fund goes towards police. We also get some grants from federal government and nonprofit organizations and contracts for services that we provide. Like in Marion County, many of us have contracts with the school district to help provide school resource officers. Other revenue is directly linked to the level of law enforcement efforts. Reductions in enforcement and adjudication will result in less revenue. We receive revenue from violations, both traffic and around here parking. I know they got my $10 last week. Criminal fines and assessments. Upon conviction of a crime, courts impose a unitary assessment, which goes to state and local general funds, as well as funding state public safety services, police officer training, and victim services. Property forfeitures. We can seize and forfeit property used in criminal activity, mostly from drug cases, and not nearly as often as we used to. Then there's cost drivers for public safety. One of them is community expectations for safety and the extent in which people are afraid of being victimized. These livability issues that they expect us to address. There's a willingness and ability of people to report crimes. The 911 system made it easier to report crimes and has increased the call volume, requiring people to send written reports of crimes instead of having officers respond to thefts as the opposite effect. Demographic changes. Increases in our population bring more workload and especially increases in the crime-prone population, and that's males age 15 to 39. You look at our demographics, we're getting a larger population of older folks and a large population of these 15 to 39-year-old males. Think of it as sheep and wolves. Law changes, ad-lib there. Law changes by elected officials or voters, mandatory arrest policy for domestic violence cases, or sentencing changes or cost drivers. Public events requiring crowd control, everything from a 4th of July parade to a presidential visit. Level of drug activity in gangs. As you know, drug and alcohol abuse is directly linked to a large number of crimes. I think you talk to any prosecutor, jail manager in their state, and they'll tell you it's the engine that pulls the crime train. Other services that are cost drivers are available to mentally ill or chemically dependent people. And we have to handle them in the criminal justice system or through some other means. You either treat them or lock them up.
Major areas of discretion. At your communication centers, call takers work with policies that establish priorities on when to dispatch an officer to a particular call. And again, these areas of discretion are continuing to increase. Police officers can decide whether to issue a citation instead of arresting the person, or whether situations can be resolved without formal action. In the past, we would take someone into custody on a felony charge and many misdemeanor charges. Now, instead of on certain felony charges, instead of being arrested, you're cited and released at the scene. This is not what we look forward to or expect in our public safety system. Prosecutors decide whether to file a criminal charge, how many charges to file, and the nature of the charges, whether that's a felony, a misdemeanor, or a violation. Prosecutors establish policies on what types of pleas to offer and accept, and whether to participate in diversion and other disposition programs. crime lab staff prioritizes what work gets done within their resources. And again, it affects the whole system. Parole and probation officers establish levels of supervision and decide when and how to punish violations of supervision conditions. With declining resources, we are faced with many difficult decisions on how to deliver public safety services. We are making policy decisions throughout Oregon, to put it in plain words, do not constitute sound corrections and law enforcement practices. This is not to the benefit of our citizens in Oregon.
Chair Williams, I don't know if you wish to entertain any questions at this point or if you wish us just to continue to move along.
Recognizing that we have a lot of people on this committee and the need to move through this program, I don't want to deny committee members the opportunity to ask questions, but I would encourage you to be prudent in your questioning. So with that in mind, is there a particular question that one would like to put to either the chief or the sheriff for Marion County?
I don't have a question. I just want to welcome, particularly since Raul is in my district, and he provides me with all the protection here, and that Mark is in the adjacent city, and I know them both, and I just want to welcome you here today.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
any questions? Okay.
For those of you, Mr. Chair, who may have detected a slight accent, ever so slight accent with Chief Adams, I would note it for you that he is from Kaiser. Kaiser is also the home of Senate President Courtney. So if you pick up crabs and those kinds of things, that might be where it came
from. That's where they came from. I thought this morning Senator...
Speaking of ad libs.
Senator Courtney sounded a little like FDR this morning when he was making his remarks in the House chamber, I thought.
Before we move into the presentation on the court process, I would like to acknowledge the presence today of Craig Campbell. You will see Craig. Craig, would you wave and stand up and say hey? Craig, you'll see for the governor's chief policy advisor in law enforcement and public safety issues. So you'll be seeing Craig around this session quite a bit as well.
Craig, are you on board yet? As of today. Welcome and congratulations.
As they come up, Mr. Chair, at this point I would like to introduce to you Peter Ozan and Jim Adams. Peter is a face that may be familiar to some of you. From 1998 to 2001, Peter was the chief counsel to the United States Attorney for the District of Oregon, directing the U.S. DOJ Strategic Approaches to Community Safety Initiative, formerly a lawyer partner in Schwabe Williamson in Portland. Peter also served as the executive for Multnomah County's Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, its first executive after those entities were created some time ago in Senate Bill 1145. He previously served as Governor Goldschmidt's advisor on corrections. Peter has returned to state service now as the executive for the newly created Public Defender Services, Office of Public Defender Services. Peter is one of those faces that you'll see quite a bit this legislative session as well. Joining him is Jim Adams. Jim is the trial court administrator in Jackson County, a position he's been in since 1990. His service to the public safety criminal justice system prior to that was in Josephine County, serving in parole and probations and also in a minimum security jail. So with that, I'll turn that over now to Peter and to Jim.
Thank you, Marla. Chair Williams, Patridge, and Winters, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to speak. Like everyone before you today, Jim and I will be speaking on behalf of a number of people who, in this case, make up the court process. Of course, we are speaking on behalf of what I'll call the usual suspects, the courts, appellate and trial courts, the circuit courts in the state, which are made up by 166 circuit court judges, the over 1,000 lawyers who appear in those courts, either as prosecutors, district attorneys, city prosecutors, or defense attorneys, either under contract or as state employees, the Attorney General's office, who represents the people of the state of Oregon in appeals of criminal cases, as well as the state defender's office. So, and along with, of course, the probation and parole officers who work with the courts as part of the court process. And indeed, the Harkle Road Shepherd, not ready for prime time skit, really had those players before you today, as well as other parts of the court process. Your materials refer to the court process as a wheel. Those men and women in the courts who appear in the courts represent perhaps the hub of that wheel. And the spokes, however, are a number of other important men and women and programs and services that depend upon or support the court processes. They include, of course, law enforcement. Officers are witnesses. State troopers and other law enforcement are expert witnesses in courts. The courts provide victim services that, when I began 30 years ago in this business, they were unheard of. We are treating victims much better than we did. We are treating witnesses and jurors, who are also part of that participants, much better and thoughtfully than we did 30 years ago. We have, as I mentioned, corrections. That includes jails and prisons, probation and parole, supporters, as well as dependent upon the court process. And then we have what are often private providers, treatment, prevention, intervention, alcohol and drug, mental health treatment, job training, education. Those are participants in the court process as well. Again, when I started, everyone thought that treatment could not be forced upon people. It didn't work, or programs. Now, 30 years later, we see the research, in fact, supports court-mandated programs and treatment. We have drug courts. We have mental health courts. We have family courts. And the court, the judge, is at the center of that, is really the authority figure that drives that treatment process. The system is, as you can see from the diagram, is, of course, state and local. We have a state court system. Part of the number of the players are funded through the counties as well as the state. We have a local court process. We have justice courts, and we have municipal courts. And as I believe it was Ross Shepherd mentioned, we do have a federal court system. The Attorney General's office handles appeals that go to the federal courts from our state criminal process. And I believe it was Doug Harkleroad mentioned that some of our jails have been the subject of federal remedy, so the courts on the federal level get into, from time to time, taking over state processes, something I can assure you, as having worked in the federal system, we don't want to have happen in Oregon, where the federal courts take over portions of the system because of lack of funding or overburdening. The players, has already been pointed out by our law enforcement colleagues and in the skit, are interrelated and interdependent. I mentioned the notion of the wheel. You've often heard of the revolving door in the criminal justice system. And maybe Chris Hansen, defendant Chris Hansen, is a representative of that revolving door. People come in and out of the court process, cycling in and out. We found in Multnomah County about 4 years ago that when we looked at those people who were booked in the jail, we saw a very small group of men and women represented a very high proportion of number of people booked. Over a five-year period, 5% of the people booked represented 20% of the bookings. And this is representative of what happens in the system. Chris Hansen's of the world represent a disproportionate number of failures who continue to recycle through the court process, demanding our resources, unless we intervene. And those men and women in that 5% that represented 20% of the bookings had a disproportionate number, disproportionate problem of mental health and alcohol and drug problems. In virtually every jurisdiction I've seen in Oregon, no one has quoted a figure of less than 60% of the offenders having an alcohol and drug or mental health problem, and it's as high as 90%. And when those services finally are not provided, it has impacts in the court process. It has impacts far beyond the court process into the community as a whole. For example, children who would receive services through our juvenile courts for abuse, physical abuse, or neglect. If not provided with those services, as we all know, the byproducts are subsequent substance abuse, school dropouts, delinquency, teenage pregnancy, and finally, back in our adult criminal system. So the message of who we are is that we are a court process that involves more than just the courtroom. We have a myriad of services and programs that are interdependent, and eliminating or reducing any of them will have an effect on the others as well as citizens of Oregon as a whole.
Thank you. Chair Williams, Chair Patridge, Chair Winters, and committee members. In terms of what we do, the authors of both our state and federal constitutions created a three-part adversarial justice system in which the courts are an independent and co-equal branch of government that is responsible for maintaining the integrity of the justice system through the rule of law, prosecution, which is responsible to safeguard the interest of the public, including victims, and public defenders who represent the accused. Our constitutions empower us, the criminal justice system, with the responsibilities to both enforce the laws and maintain social order. However, for the system to function properly, an adversarial balance between the three branches must be consistently maintained. A view of the state and justice court data on the screens above us, and I need to preface with the fact that municipal court data is not available, indicates three compelling issues. The number of persons appearing before Oregon's criminal justice system is significant. State courts adjudicate the majority of adult and juvenile cases, and municipal and justice courts play a vital role in the disposition of traffic, code violations, and minor offenses. We could go to the next slide. Continuing on with what the justice system does, we in general administer the laws that are created by this body, the Oregon Legislature. A brief summary of a few of those are: we prosecute adult crimes and juvenile delinquent acts. We provide indigent defense counsel as constitutionally required for those adults charged with crimes and juveniles delinquent acts. We protect from domestic assault. We protect children from abuse and neglect. We enforce child support. We protect our mentally ill and other vulnerable citizens. And we protect or ensure the compliance of court contract law and timely resolution of business disputes. Because any substantive action to an entity of the criminal justice system has a profound effect on the other stakeholders, the system is referred to as an interdependent system. Within interdependent systems, either an increase or decrease in any entity will result in backlogs and cost transfers to the other stakeholders. Therefore, if the state increases the capacity of prosecution resources without addressing other system stakeholders, if we apply this concept of an interdependent system model, we can predict, in addition to making Marla very happy, the following outcomes. We can predict an increase in the number of cases filed with the court, related delays, particularly in areas of family law and business law, because in the criminal justice domain, there are mandated time frames from which we have to process cases, particularly in in-custody cases, and corresponding increases in cost. The same is true in the backlogs that result in both indigent defense and their cost, in prosecution and their cost. Also, in terms of backlogs in jails and prisons, there's also an increase in the number of persons sentenced on probation into DHS programs that would result, and an increase in law enforcement costs related to trial preparation and appearances. Conversely, if there was a decrease in prosecution services, there would be an inverse backlog leading to similar issues. Regarding whom we affect, legislative funding decisions are public policy decisions which shape the criminal justice system and how it impacts the citizens in both outside that system. For example, Peter, why don't I turn that over to you? I'm sorry.
It's all right. Well, obviously, the court process is one of the centerpieces of the public safety system. that exists to protect all Oregonians from crime. But as Jim has mentioned, the adversarial process run by the courts is to ensure fairness in the process of prosecuting crime. One of the other things that the court process does that I don't think is mentioned as enough as it should be, and I think it's, I know when it's mentioned you'll all recognize it, we call it, the lawyers and the judges in the courtroom really guardians and stewards of the laws you create. It's not only enforcing them for public safety purposes, it's ensuring by applying laws in individual cases and by appealing them and contesting them that the laws you create are administered rationally and consistently. So the court process's role as guardians of the laws is critical. Among the folks we serve in the court process, as I mentioned earlier and that were ignored in the beginning, are the victims and the witnesses. And today there is much care devoted to providing compensation for witnesses or for victims, treating victims and witnesses with sensitivity throughout the court process. The offenders who appear before the courts, as I mentioned earlier, are often the mentally ill or the drug dependent. And the courts, through the treatment, court order treatment programs, can affect those folks. And if we don't have those programs, those folks often wind up in the jail untreated. And as I mentioned before, they represent in Multnomah County that 5% who create 20% of the problems in terms of repeated crimes. We are, of course, part of the public safety system. And that public safety system first punishes offenders who deserve it. It incapacitates offenders who are dangerous. And it deters the rest of us who are watching. And if that court process is overburdened, broken down, incapable of performing the roles that you demand of it, it loses its credibility. It loses its impact on society. It loses its effect as a moral force. And if the court can't handle its caseloads in the criminal area, the costs are shifted to the private sector. Businesses have to provide their own security. As a prosecutor, the first thing one hears from a business owner is saying, "What do you mean? I just caught somebody in my store shoplifting, and they let him go or gave him a traffic ticket." And finally, the court process ensures that Oregon is the place you and I want to live and work, and other people who come here want to live here and work here.
Regarding sources of revenue, the stakeholders of the court system vary significantly regarding the sources of revenue that comprise our budget, including the percentage of resources that are derived from the state general fund. Therefore, the volatility associated with the state general fund varies accordingly. Specific examples include the indigent defense account is a 100% general fund dependent account. The state court operations are 92% dependent on the state general fund. District attorney's office are approximately 20% dependent on state general funds, and the attorney general's office approximately 13%. However, I would exercise a word of caution in interpreting general fund dependency because it can be misleading. For example, the state courts recover approximately 78% of their total operational costs through the imposition and collection of fines, fees, restitution. Almost all of these resources are redirected back to municipal, county, state, and victim programs. The sources of dedicated funds, as you can read on the screen, for the general fund for the criminal justice system include the state income tax, property taxes, fines, fees, assessments, and federal and nonprofit grants. I believe it's important to note that applying the interdependent system model, that a reduction in general funds to any specific entity within the criminal justice system has a corresponding result systematically, jeopardizing essential infrastructure programs and services. A couple examples are: a reduction in trial court resources will adversely affect the ability to impose and collect fines and fees that benefit the public and other agencies that depend on these resources. And just a few of the places where traditional fees and fines go to through the state court system are the State General Fund, Victim Restitution Programs, the Police Academy, Law Enforcement Medical Fund, municipal and county law enforcement agencies, and others. A second area that is finally balanced is the ability to preserve and protect existing federal and nonprofit grants that we now enjoy and depend on throughout the system. A classic example of that is in earlier sessions, the legislature appropriated sufficient funds to create a number of drug court programs throughout Oregon. In Jackson County, we were able to, with the hiring of a single coordinator and a clerk, to generate $5.4 million in federal and nonprofit grants within the first 12-month period of time of the program. However, any reduction in those general fund services to the drug court will result in a concurrent loss of those grants simply because it's the sole source of the matching funds. In terms of cost drivers, the most profound cost driver of the court systems are related to public policy issues, including federal and state legislative mandates and ballot measures. Consequently, any changes should be thoroughly analyzed to understand the impacts on the many programs of the criminal justice system. And unfunded mandates, such as those set forth in the American Disabilities Act, juvenile dependency, domestic violence, and others, must also be met. And for example, in 1997, Congress enacted the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which created case processing and timely disposition standards for juvenile dependency cases, which we affectionately refer to as ASPA. Consequently, the Oregon legislature aligned our statutes to comply with the federal laws in 1999. The impacts of the unfunded congressional mandates on our court system increased cost in both the courts, prosecution, public defenders, and Department of Human Services child welfare programs. Yet we're not in a position to fail to comply with AFSA standards. Specifically, our Title 4E, or foster care reimbursements, are directly linked to our compliance with these standards, in both in terms of case processing and timely disposition. Further, we are currently now, as a result of insufficient budget resources, in a position that we are under an improvement plan under the Title 4E because of our inability to comply with these standards. Further reductions in dependency will reduce and pose a real and substantial threat to federal foster care reimbursements, which in this state total more than $90 million annually. Another substantial cost driver includes shifting priorities and resources within law enforcement entities. Therefore, legislative and executive officials charged with the oversight of public safety must be aware that absent a balanced budget approach to the criminal justice system, significant and unintended systems and budgetary consequences can and will occur. An illustrative example was given earlier in terms of what would happen with a decrease in funding in a prosecutor's office. In Jackson County, we have a concentrated effort in the city of Medford to enforce DUII laws. We have the highest arrest rate per populace in Oregon. The result of that action by the city council is an increase in case filings before the circuit court, backlogs and increased costs in the court, prosecutor, corrections, and DHS programs, increased system revenues, an increase in the number of persons sentenced to our jails and prisons, increased pressure on the legislature to shift resources from existing programs to the criminal justice system, and increased public safety. The final slide in terms of cost drivers continued. There are also a number of still significant drivers, including demographic changes. As we know, we're incurring an increase in our Hispanic populations, which has resulted in an increased demand for public interpreter services. Changes in prosecution filing practices. I can recall back in the early 80s in Josephine County when a district attorney was elected on the platform of not plea negotiating. That had significant consequences to that community and ultimately resulted in a single term of office for that DA. The availability of OSP forensic crime labs and the ability of prevention and intervention services. The necessity, I too want to share that the necessity for alcohol drug treatment as well as mental health treatment services for multiple criminal offense and juvenile delinquent acts are imperative to retain the balance of effective strategies for how we address and sentence people, as well as provide for alternative sanctions for more costly jail.
I wanted to conclude with talking a little about discretion in the court process system, and each of the presenters today is going to talk about this topic. It seems to me it's critical for legislators to know where the discretion lies in the system, both to figure out who's in a best position to respond to either more money or, in this environment, less money, cuts in budgets, and what might be the unintended consequences or planned consequences of particular cuts or strategies by the legislature. So discretion and where it's exercised throughout the criminal justice system is important, and we'd like to highlight a few of those areas of discretion for you in the court process. I think the thought of the average citizen that the courts are really at the helm with all the discretion, ironically, is not really true in Oregon. Discretion is really in the front end of the system. We've had our law enforcement colleagues already talk to us about the discretion the officer has to charge someone with an offense and arrest them. In the court processes we're examining it today, the first decisions that are made are by prosecutors in terms of deciding to charge someone with a crime, whether it's felony or misdemeanor or violation, or in the important area of mandatory sentencing crimes like ballot measure 11, will that crime be charged at all? And if it is, that decision becomes, I would submit, the most important decision next to the ones you make in creating the crimes. Diversion and early disposition of cases is an early front-end decision where there's a great deal of discretion exercised by the lawyers. Prosecutors on behalf of the state, defense attorneys on behalf of the defendant, to determine whether these folks should be diverted out of the criminal system into some form of treatment, intervention, or prevention program. Plea bargaining, we're all familiar with, is a major area of discretion, again, where charges or sentences are negotiated between the attorneys, and that agreement is presented to the courts. The courts is in this overhead in front of you have limited discretion, by comparison, very little discretion once the case is presented as a plea bargain by the lawyers or a case is charged and goes to trial by the prosecutors. It is determined by the plea bargaining decisions or the charging decisions of, that is, generally what is the sentence. Now, certainly there are within the laws discretion by the court to impose sentences within the guidelines or in other forms of law within a certain limited amount of discretion. The courts have decisions regarding postponement and in some cases dismissal of decisions of cases, but that discretion is fairly limited. The appellate courts, as I mentioned earlier, as guardians or stewards of the law, have discretion, but it's limited by what prior case precedent is, what the statutes are that you impose. So, again, the courts, per se, have limited ability to exercise discretion. It is confined by the law or by decisions made by lawyers prior to the case arriving before the judge. There are a set of decisions that are being, as you all know, presented to the courts now in terms of budget cuts, and there the courts have limited discretion, and it's generally being exercised in terms of access to the courts. Staff is being cut, which reduces the ability of the courts to process workloads. There are fewer obvious in-court hours. The courts just simply can't handle the business, as Jim has mentioned, that's generally it's called upon to perform. I guess in conclusion, and many others will be saying this, and we could say it generally of the criminal justice system, but it's certainly true of the court process. It's made up of independent parts. The parts depend on each other. If one is cut, or indeed if one is given additional resources, it has an effect on the others. But cuts to one component of this system, the Ross Shepherd, Doug Harkle Road, not ready for prime time play shows the impact on other components, players, agencies in the system. And those cuts have consequences, of course, inside the system. But as I know all of you are concerned, most importantly, those cuts to the criminal, to the court processes have impacts on our citizens as a whole in terms of added security, greater fears of crime, and most importantly, just the feeling about, is Oregon the place we want to live and raise our families, and do businesses want to move here? I think that's what's at stake. Thank you for your attention.
Chair Williams, I hope that you and your colleagues are getting the notion here that you really do owe some gratitude to Council Taylor, as well as to Robin and to Doug in Legislative Fiscal, because by putting us all together to do this mapping, you see that we have a greater appreciation as well on the interrelationships and the interdependence, and we're all in this together. We'd like to do one more component part today if we could, and then take a break after the corrections folks and pick up again tomorrow if that's okay with you.
That'd be fine.
I'd like at this point, thanks, guys.
Yes, I think, Representative Crummell, do you have your prudent question?
I do. I have, I think, is a prudent question, and actually you can answer it later if you'd like to. But it came out in the presentation by the prime time players who are not yet ready for prime time players, and that is with regards to the mentally ill and the drug dependent persons, and the court ordered intervention and treatment. With regards to in the play, the person was basically turned away from treatment and intervention, even though he had willingly tried to follow the court order and go to that. I guess it really brings up two questions. One is how can it be that a person that is trying to follow a court order can be turned away on a court order? And the second is with regards to the... Well, go ahead and just answer and deal with that part first, if you want to wait.
Representative Crummell, what I would recommend that we do is reserve that question and that answer for tomorrow. You will see in a couple of the case studies that we'll present tomorrow, Judge Abernathy will be here, as will Jeff Davis from the Marion County Mental Health Department, two uniquely positioned folks to be able to respond directly to what you're asking.
Okay. That'd be fine. Thank you.
Is that satisfactory, Representative?
Yes.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Williams. One of my observations among the lineup was that the employment department wasn't part of that. And I know there's a lot of secondary players.
Yeah.
There's numerous, but it would appear to me that part of reducing recidivism rates in Oregon is making sure that the employment department plays a key role in finding these people work.
Chair Williams, Representative Smith, you're absolutely correct. We could have brought in a good number of other participants throughout state, local governments, as well as the private nonprofits as well. We could have had individuals from the school system, individuals from employment, because if you go back and look at the risk factors, and you remember what Ross Shepard said, a prototypical, in a very general sense, a typical client of his might look like, low income, low education. So you're dead solid right. We're mindful that they are critical players in the overall well-being as well.
Thank you.
Why don't we go ahead and move on to the next portion then? Thank you both very much for your presentation.
As they come up, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce you and your colleagues to Karen Brazeau and Ben DeHaan. Karen is the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. She was OYA's first deputy director when it was created as a brand new state agency back in 1996. She's been the director since August of 2000. Perhaps, Representative Smith, this is a critical piece as well. Karen, in one of her former lives, was the associate superintendent for special education at the Oregon Department of Education. Her responsibilities there included providing the educational services in McLaren and Hillcrest. So mindful that it's all related together. Karen has focused her career for a good number of years on services to children and to youth. With her is Ben DeHaan. Ben is the interim director, Dr. DeHaan. I keep calling him Ben. I'm so sorry. Is the interim director for the Oregon Department of Corrections. Ben has been in state service, in public service, for 25-some years. He's administered a number of human services programs. He's directed a very unique and exciting university-based research center, has conducted research in the area of family violence, and has worked as a consultant in corrections and in human services across the country. So with that...
And Dr. DeHaan, I think I have a little sinus infection, so can I write...
Wrong kind of doctor.
All right.
Representative Williams, I'm not the kind of doctor that'll do you any good.
Welcome.
He's the kind of doctor that in my hometown in Gateway, we think they stand for post hole diggers, so there you go. That would be a PhD, Ben.
Oh. I thought it was piled higher and deeper. Chairs Winters, Patridge, and Williams, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm not altogether accustomed with an intro like that. Usually I just come up here and try and get out as quickly as possible, so it's a little bit embarrassing. Anyway, Karen and I will try and do a tag team this afternoon. What we'd like to do is to address the adult system and the juvenile system in close proximity. Not combine them by any sense of the word, but we're going to try and talk to you at the same time. The slides that you're going to be going through will also combine the areas where it makes sense. And in some areas, I think we'll try and separate those differences. I'm going to be generally working through slides 31 through 45 or so in your packet, but I'm going to take a lot of license and move through them very quickly because I don't think I need to sit here and read all this to you. Who we are, the Oregon Department of Corrections, obviously manages adult prisons, and that's pretty clear. The Oregon Youth Authority, of course, manages the juvenile offenders, but we would also point out that there are 300 DOC folks also being served over in juvenile corrections. The system is also comprised of local jails, community corrections, and a variety of juvenile programs, or it would be the equivalent of juvenile community corrections. And also we include in our discussion the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. So we'd like to show you sort of the whole piece. On the next page, slide 32, who we are. County jails obviously handle felonies and misdemeanor offenders. The Oregon DOC has 12 prisons, and I think you've all seen maps of where they're located. They're pretty much scattered around the state. Community corrections offers services for parole and probation and post-prison supervision, and obviously the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision sets terms for supervision and post-prison supervision mostly.
Chairs and members of the committee, the juvenile correction system in Oregon was revised in 1995 through Senate Bill 1. As a result of recognizing that Oregon's system, much like the rest of the country's system, was not working well. And what we have today is a state juvenile correction system, the Oregon Youth Authority, that manages about 2,700 high-risk juvenile offenders. The bulk of the state's youth offenders, however, are managed through your local juvenile departments, and on a daily basis they touch about 18,000 kids. And I think that it's important to have a picture of those numbers because it's regularly thought that the juvenile system still isn't working. But if you imagine 18,000 kids coming into the juvenile justice system on any given day, and the truth of it is about 60% of those kids never have more than a single contact with your local juvenile department. That's all it takes for them to go back on the straight and narrow. And for the remaining, a small percentage go on to create the bulk of the juvenile crime that you hear about, and an even small percentage on any given day, only about 2,700 are committed to the state, even because the seriousness of their crime warrants that. In addition, there are crime prevention activities that take place both at the state and local level as well. What do we do? At the Youth Authority, we exercise the legal and physical custody of these 2,700 serious offenders, and it's very different than the adult system. They are under the age of 18 when they commit the crime, and they come to us because they are still considered to be minors in need of the same kind of care and parenting, if you will, as other minors in the state. And in addition, they have committed very serious crimes. They also have significant mental health issues. Over 60% have a diagnosed very serious mental health condition, and almost all of them are also very seriously involved with drugs and alcohol. Through the Youth Authority, we also provide funding to counties to divert youth from the Youth Authority. There is general agreement that, to the extent possible, most youth are better served in their home communities, staying in touch with their families, enrolled in their local schools, and only removed when all those systems have been able to, not been able to maintain them. The county juvenile departments supervise youth who are on county probation, and those youth typically are remaining in their homes. They're youth who have become involved in the legal system, have, where's Bill Taylor, who needs to tell me if I'm talking loud enough. They're kids who have been involved in criminal activity, but it's not has not reached a level of seriousness that requires removal from their home, and their home is still a safe enough place for them to remain. Also, the Criminal Justice Commission provides funding from the state to the counties to provide some secondary kinds of juvenile crime prevention activities to teens who are at the most risk of entering the juvenile, the state's juvenile justice system, that being the Youth Authority. Yep.
The next slide on slide 35 gives you the number, the relative proportions of the people that you find in jails. Work release beds are 8,000. Again, the Department of Corrections houses 12,000 adult males. But what may not have been clear from the earlier presentation is that those serving a year or less are served, you've all heard of 1145, they're all served locally, and we contract with the communities for that. You can see that there are 30,000 felons being supervised in the communities, another 15,000 misdemeanants, so you can get an idea that there's a lot of action at the community level, many times larger than the adult correction system if you think about institutions alone. Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision sets the sentence length and supervision conditions. They stopped doing, parole was actually after 1989, it's post-prison supervision. It's the best way to explain that. Next slide, 36, who we affect. The adult correction system, when you consider its growth, I think affects a tremendous amount of people. You should be clear that, at least in our system, we have two big responsibilities. One is holding people accountable, obviously leaving them in prison to the absolute time that they deserve. They should be there. And we also spend a lot of time thinking about what happens post-release, and that's a very critical piece that we should talk about. If you think about the public safety system in general, our success really does depend on other pieces of this system. You can't think only about the correction system and not think about what happens when we release inmates, and we release hundreds of inmates each month. The success at the local level, the success for those programs really does equate to our success overall. A piece of the system that has not gotten a lot of play, and I'm referring to slide 37, is the effect that we have and that the system has on victims. We've spent a lot more time on that lately. There's an automated notification system that works most of the time, and we hold inmates accountable for paying restitution and so forth. So you should hear that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in that area. There's we've only, I think, scratched the surface. We need to do a lot more work there. The if you think about what kinds of effects we have on inmates, obviously a prison system is a very powerful intervention. There's no doubt. It's very powerful. It's very expensive. And you'll hear lots of discussion about recidivism. It is true that two-thirds of the inmates that go through our system don't come back. I mean, that's clear. But it's not an easy number to get a hold of. There are lots of things that contribute to inmate success in the community. It is not only the experiences in the prison system, but also, again, the quality of supervision that they receive locally, even things like the number of law enforcement persons available. The quality of supervision is a key issue in determining whether or not an inmate is successful post-release.
Many of the things that Ben talked about in the correction system and who it affects apply also to the juvenile corrections system. The juvenile corrections system, like the adult corrections system, is becoming more and more sensitive to the needs of victims, and we have joined with the corrections system on the victim notification piece and also our moving our transition programs to ensure that the youth have more opportunities for paid work that will provide restitution payment to the victims and achieving more success in that as well. Moving to page 39 on the sources of revenue, the truth is that corrections programs are paid primarily by state general funds. There are some other funds that go into the payment of correction services, but the bulk of it is strictly general funds. We are able to construct some facilities with certificates of participation. We're always chasing federal dollars for little grants to build some facilities. We're always chasing federal dollars at both the state and local level to provide specialized kinds of programs and services. The Youth Authority has access to some federal funds, as do the local juvenile departments for programming in the community, but not in any, not for any kids who are incarcerated. We certainly look for any opportunities for private or non-profit kinds of grants, but the truth of it is it's almost all general fund in all corrections programs, and as expensive as the buildings are, the real cost in corrections is staffing those buildings 24 hours a day and maintaining them over the long haul.
If you refer to slide 40, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the cost drivers in the adult system. I think you saw in an earlier slide that the Department of Corrections is one of the few departments that is continuing to grow. And the biggest cost driver for that is the number of people that enter the system. Everything else really is driven, or most of the rest of it is driven, by the number of people who are incarcerated. The number of people coming into our system is driven in large part by sentence length. It's about 41 months now. It's doubled in about roughly in the last decade, and our population has pretty much doubled within that same period of time. The demographics also exert an influence on the adult system. It's probably more pronounced in the juvenile system for obvious reasons of aging into crime-prone years. The demographics in the adult system actually pale by comparison to simply the sentence length and population increases. If you look at slide 41, other cost drivers, the one that I want to really highlight for you is the just the rising costs of incarceration alone. Medical costs, we're dealing with a group of people, as far as I know, it's the only group of people who have the constitutional right to medical care. And the medical standards are fairly clearly laid out in the Constitution. The cost of pharmaceuticals, particularly psychotropics, drugs that we give to the mentally ill, very, very expensive. And then the other big cost driver is the labor agreements. In our instance, I'm not sure about the juvenile system, but certainly in the adult system, is driven through interest arbitration. That is, our folks can't strike, and when we negotiate an agreement, we pay the rate that the arbiter generally finds for us. On slide 42, the other cost driver is the availability of effective child and juvenile services. This is basically the quintessential prevention argument. I mean, we can make that argument in the adult system just as we can in any other system. The reality is that the forces that propel these people into the system can be mitigated through social programs. We know that. And to the extent that we cut back on those programs, we also influence the extent to which these folks come into the adult system. So that is it's true in the corrections business, and it's true.
And the extent to which they come back into both of the systems.
And that's an excellent point, because we've calculated that for every failure at the Department of Corrections, every time someone comes back through the front door, because of the increased length of stay, that costs taxpayers about $57,000. So the point that I'm trying to make here is the investment in those things that increase the likelihood of success pays off very well. Representative Butler asked the question earlier on, and we'll calculate those costs, but it's a compelling argument. There's no doubt about that.
In the under the areas of discretion in the youth authority or in the juvenile justice system, there are certainly many more ways that discretion can be applied. And in fact, we're all about to experience some in that the state system, the youth authority, currently we're about to shrink and have four fewer youth correctional facilities. And how we are able to do that is that we do not have determinate sentences like the state system does or the adult system does. The courts commit youth to the youth authority. The youth authority director has paroling authority and can parole a youth to the community. Ben does not have that similar authority. We can make determinate decisions about where to place youth and can place them according to the budgetary constraints that are placed upon us as an agency. That all has to be balanced, of course, by this body and the risk that it's willing to assume to do that. Within the county level, between the juvenile departments and the courts and the DAs, there is always discussion about how to charge a youth for a particular crime, whether to charge that youth if he or she is age 15, whether to charge the youth as an adult or as a juvenile, for example, whether to put the youth on a formal accountability agreement rather than move forward with anything that moves the youth further into the system and results in a placement at the youth authority at all. So all of it is quite fluid in the juvenile justice system. It can also work the other way, though, that with youth who are over the age of 15, if under a tightening in the juvenile system, if DAs feel that the only way to secure a bed is to charge a youth with a Measure 11 crime, they may feel that that's the route to go rather than move back down the system and keep the youth in the juvenile system. So it's a much more fluid kind of system than the adult court and adult law with its determinate sentencing.
The last few slides that we'll go through is our attempt at showing you that the discretion in the adult system is variable. County jails have slightly more than the adult system. They can determine who gets sanctioned in a jail bed and who doesn't. And as you've seen so graphically on the news recently, they have the authority to release when they can't afford to keep inmates in jail. As Karen said, the Department of Corrections has no such authority, and when someone gets sentenced to us, we have to find a place, whether it's on a day room floor, in a gym, or wherever. We have to take them. And then the last slide will show you that there is some a little more discretion in the community correction system. They have the ability to case bank or reduce the levels of supervision, and they have an opportunity to mix community sanctions with jail time. So that, in a nutshell, is the presentation on corrections, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Ben, I've got a question, and it comes from the Judiciary Committee's trip to Coffee Creek, and I remember you identified, I think, the bed count situation that you were at the time, and then not just at Coffee Creek, but system-wide. And are you currently over capacity by about 1,200 beds? Is that what I recall?
Representative Williams, I can't tell you exactly what the capacity is today, but we are somewhere in that neighborhood. We're probably over 250, 300. I'd have to check for
you. Okay, over 250 or 300 beds over capacity.
But we're definitely over capacity, and I heard this morning that the forecast is also up by 125 beds above the forecast. So, of course, that means for us that the system is getting even further out of a line. The number 441 is the number of emergency beds that we are anticipating having to use through the remainder of this biennium.
Right.
And as you will recall, there is no building going on now, and we don't project to do any through 03-05. And we'll have to absorb between 800 and 1,000 inmates in the next budget, as it stands now.
And Karen, if I could, on our trip to McLaren, you gave us some figures of the number of youth that you're anticipating using your powers of release, essentially, through a risk assessment process and releasing the least risky of the youth that you currently have under and transferring from those closed facilities to your currently operating facilities. How many youth are you releasing in response to this?
Chair Williams and members of the committees, we are beginning the process of releasing 250 youth from closed custody.
And those will be released over the next
4 weeks.
Yes, Representative Senator Winters. I'm not used to saying that. Senator Winters, and then we'll move our way down the table.
That's quite all right. I'll come back and visit him. just a couple questions. There was a lot of discussion about mental health. What percentage of your population, Ben, is mental health now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, about 20% of the adult population has a serious mental health issue diagnosis.
And Karen, what's the percentage in the Youth Authority?
Chair Winters, in the institutions, it's about 60%. In our total population, it's about 55%.
Are mental health connected?
Yes.
And what percentage are drug and alcohol related?
I'm not sure I can remember off the top of my head the drug and alcohol, but it's similarly high. It's a little bit higher than the mental health.
How about you, Ben?
Mr. Chair, Senator Williams, it's about 80%. That, I think, is a conservative estimate.
Senator Gordley?
Thank you. questions for both of you. In both of your systems, are there any pending lawsuits related to mental health or other inability to provide services?
Chairs and Senator Gordley, in the Youth Authority, there is not a pending lawsuit. There's the threat of a lawsuit on exactly that topic.
Mental health?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I am unaware of any now, but I don't know if Scott, do you know of any? I don't think we have any presently.
Follow up. for Ms. Rizzo. The 250 youth who will be released from custody, they are being released to what form of community custody?
Chairs and Senator Gordley, it's a variety. We are also taking about a $3.1 million cut on the community side of our program, so we're moving a number of youth out of community services. So we are, some of the youth in close custody will go into some community programs that might be treatment centers. Some, I just read a list today, actually, of the youth going back to Multnomah County, which I could provide for you, that will be released on parole and returned to their homes. So there are a significant number who will simply go back to their homes. Others who are in the community will go back to their homes to open up spaces for others leaving closed custody beds that are too dangerous or don't have homes to go back to. So it's a variety of placements.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley asked it for me.
Oh, okay. Good. Anything else? Thank you very much for your presentation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Crummell.
And you don't have to give the answer today, but I'm just curious about the cost of county mental health versus the cost of incarceration. As we saw, again, going back to the less than prime time players, they depicted that the defendant went to the DOC. So what was the cost of sending that person to the DOC for incarceration for 15 months, only 12 of which he would actually serve, versus had that person been served through the county mental health services?
I see Robin and Doug both writing feverishly, so I'm sure that they'll work on an answer
Mr. Chair, I'm curious about one other thing, and again, this would be an answer for later. It was stated in the prime time, less than prime time play, that our schools are failing our kids, and I have a real problem with that statement. I guess I'd like to find out what percent of kids, of all the kids that we have in the state, what's the percentage of kids that have problems? And what's, I guess that's it. What's the percentage of, of the kids' population who are, and what's the percentage of the kids' population who are in, somewhere in the justice system?
Mr. Chair, if I may, we'll be able to begin touching on that, Representative Crummell, tomorrow when we hear, this is a perfect segue, when we hear from Donna Middleton and Scott Taylor on intervention and prevention matters. We'll also get into four case studies for you to show you some examples of what happens. We'll begin the process also of outlining options that may exist for you for cost-cutting purposes or efficiency purposes, and then work with the committee, its chairs, in determining where we go from here. We'll begin, this is the we collectively, we'll begin the process of beginning to flesh out those very questions that Representative Crummell and others have. We appreciate very much, this is on behalf of the primetime players, this is going to go to Doug and Ross's head, something fierce, by the way, because they thought they were creative enough to keep your attention. We're pleased that we were able to keep your attention for the balance of the afternoon following that. You've been incredibly attentive. I'm beginning to like afternoon committees because I've noticed you're far less feisty than you are in the mornings.
It's lunch.
It is a good thing, and we hope that continues through tomorrow.
Thank you.
But we'll be back, and we'll conclude that tomorrow and then work with you on the follow-up to those questions.
Thank you. I want to remind the committee members to keep your notebooks with you and bring your notebooks back tomorrow. As you noted today, that if you get here on time, you get the good seats. if you get here a little later, poor Senator Morris, you get the cheap seats. So come early and get the good seats. Senator Gordley, you have a final comment?
It doesn't take. What I need from you and the previous panels, and I think it will serve all of us well, and this is with an eye toward helping us make rational, thoughtful decisions about the reductions that are going to be made. if you will be as forthright as you can possibly be about what is irrational that may come to us or that we may be considering, that would be very helpful, very useful, and that's what I'm asking for at this juncture.
And I think all the presenters heard that. I want to thank the presenters and the team that put this together, and obviously we've got another day's worth of material to still go through. But thank you very much, and for all of you attending, we will be adjourned until tomorrow.
Did you get that study?